you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Start your Saturday with something that will grow your kiddos' brains and get their creative juices flowing. Join us at LAS in Pasadena for a morning of multilingual readings, interactive performances, and lots of kid fun. It's Super Fun Saturday on June 1st. Get your tickets at las.com/events.
LAS Studios.
I was so blown away, and I noticed it was on the National Register of Historic Places, and I was like, if I've never heard of this thing after 40 years of living in Los Angeles, what else could be on the National Register that I need to know about?
This is How to LA, the podcast that helps you discover new and old things about Los Angeles. I'm your host, Brian De Los Santos. If you're an Angeleno and you're on Instagram or TikTok, there is a pretty good chance that the algorithm has suggested this account to you.
Hiya, Instagram. I'm Eitan, and I love LA. Hi, it's Eitan. I'm here in Pasadena.
Hi, everybody.
It's Eitan, and today I'm in Studio City at a super significant site for the history of all of California.
This big guy right behind me is the Point Vicente Lighthouse. It is.
Behold, the Holmes Shannon House, an opulent craft.
Thanks for doing LA with me.
That's a sampling of posts from Eitan Does LA. It's run by Eitan Rosenblum, and there's a really fun concept behind it. On his website and socials, Eitan features places in LA County that are included on the National Register of Historic Places. From famous places like Angels Flight Railway in downtown LA, or the Beverly Wilshire Hotel in Beverly Hills, to a lot of other spots that are less well known. The National Register is overseen by the National Park Service, and it's the official list of what the federal government considers, quote, historic places worthy of preservation. There are 600 spots in LA, and Eitan's goal is to see all of them.
So far, I've written about 189 of the landmarks. I've visited another 40 or so beyond that that I haven't written or posted about yet. So there's a lot coming up.
Back in February, we met up with Eitan at one of the locations on the National Register, just a short drive from our studios in Pasadena.
Hi, I'm Eitan Rosenblum. I am the owner, blogger, founder, writer, social mediator, occasional trespasser for Eitan Does LA.
His day job is in the marketing department for ASCAP, the music licensing agency for songwriters and composers. And for Eitan Does LA, he tries to post about one new site a week, which involves researching and writing about it and filming and editing a video.
The side hustle. I won't even call it a side hustle because hustle like implies money, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't pay a bill, let alone the bills, you know? But I find that those two parts of my world feed into each other in kind of unexpected and fun ways.
We asked Eitan to show us something on the register that we might not know about already. And when we said Pasadena, one of his first thoughts was bungalow courts.
I think there are still about 100 of them left in Pasadena, 30 on the National Register. So the way that this one was preserved, I find this a really fascinating preservation story.
But first, what are bungalow courts? They're multifamily housing structures made up of small one-story houses or duplexes, usually all facing a shared courtyard. In Pasadena, it's generally considered their birthplace.
The whole point is that there is some kind of central area that's communal space. So you have this combination of detached units which give a sense of privacy, like a single-family home. But then there's also the communal living, which gives you more security, a sense of community, you know, all that stuff. And what you'll notice in a lot of them is that cars are nowhere to be found. There's maybe one or two that I've seen that have the driveway going down the middle. All the other ones, the driveway's in the side, the garages are in the back. So it's really just a safe place for people to, you know, live and work.
We met up with Eitan at Gartz Court. It's made up of four small homes and one duplex. They're all a combination of Craftsman and Tudor styles, with chimneys and foundations covered in arroyo stones, and they all face a landscaped courtyard. Garth's Court was built in 1910, making it the oldest bungalow court in Pasadena. But where it's located now is not where it was originally.
So it was 1982, and there's a company called Montgomery Engineering that's like headquartered literally next door to Garth's Court. It was on Madison Avenue, which is like just south of where the 210 is right now. And they were like, all right, we're going to demolish Garth's Court. So they even evicted the tenants. I think it was mostly students at the time. And we're going to create more office space for us to move into to expand our headquarters. But that area was zoned for residential use, and so they had to like apply to the city for what's called a variance to change what they were allowed to do with that area. And so the city caught wind of it, as did Pasadena Heritage, which is a very important preservation organization in your fair city. They're still active today. And so they worked together with Montgomery Engineering to develop a plan where basically the city said, okay, Montgomery, you can have your variance and build your office, but you have to agree not to demolish the court and to let us move it to somewhere else, you know, instead of demolishing it. And so they agreed to it. And in 1984, in the dead of night, there were a bunch of trucks that took each of the units on the road to where they are right now. So they've been here for the past 40 years, and they were in their old location for the 70 years before that.
As to why other bungalow courts needed preserving.
Well, so the height of the bungalow court craze was sort of between 1910 and 1930. And there were hundreds and hundreds of bungalow courts in Pasadena, but also LA more broadly. By the 1930s, the craze kind of died down because there were new mandates about parking. So it became no longer economically feasible to build something like this with this few people living on it, with the number of parking spots that were required by the city. So a lot of them start being knocked down, you know, to make room for other things. And so by like the 80s, a lot of them are just gone.
Something you were talking about was that this particular bungalow courtyard was built before cars were the biggest thing in LA. Mm-hmm. That kind of makes me put on like my thinking cap and be like, well, these were constructed in Pasadena, which is north of the downtown hub area of Los Angeles. I just imagine how people were kind of like remote and living kind of like away from the hustle and bustle of either Hollywood out there or downtown. Can you kind of just take us back a little bit of that lifestyle back in the days?
Sure. Well, you know, Pasadena came up in the late 19th century, and it really started as like almost like a sleepy bedroom community. A lot of people talk about it being sort of a winter location, a wintering location for wealthy folks from the Midwest and the East. They'd come out here during the cold months, you know, they might have a second house or just like rent something out here. That said, by the time bungalow courts were becoming more popular, Pasadena was becoming like a mini metropolis on its own. So you're right that cars weren't quite a thing in 1910, becoming more popular, but they hadn't taken over yet. But there were like red car lines, like the Pacific Electric red car lines everywhere. If you've ever seen one of those old maps of the red car lines, like they were extensive. So especially a little bit further south of here, like you could walk out of some of the other bungalow courts and be right there at a stop. So, you know, if you're elderly or if you work downtown, it wouldn't be that difficult for you to get there.
What happened, man? What happened? I mean, that's just a comment, not a question, but you know, I see the documentaries or even like the entertainment highlighting how LA was back then. I'm like, yeah. It was electric, not a trolley. What were they?
It's basically
a trolley. Yeah.
I feel the same way. It's like, I don't know that nostalgia is the right word because like we weren't alive when that happened, but I definitely feel some kind of yearning for popular, accessible public transportation that they had back then.
And the sense of community that a bungalow court was designed to provide is something that you can feel when you're there too.
I'm Hani Fox.
And who is this?
This is my little dog, my little poodle Buns. Ooh, like that.
We got him on tape.
Hani is the newest resident of Garth's Court.
I bought this home about a year and a half ago, and I'm a real estate agent, and I have a huge passion for historic homes. And it's so nice. I mean, everyone, we're all a little community here. And last week, Danny fixed my original door handle that was falling off. And yeah, it's really nice.
We didn't get a chance to talk to Danny, but we did talk to the earliest resident of the complex, John Sigler.
My wife and I were newly married, looking for a house, and we saw it in the paper. Because of the history of it with the city and Pasadena Heritage, it was on front page of the Star News. And so he said, hey, that looks cute. And it was. And, you know, as soon as you walked in, you got the feeling. And the rest is history.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Eitan Rosenblum about how he got into this project, going to all of the LA spots on the National Register of Historic Places, and what he gets out of it. We'll be right back.
Hey, what's up, y'all? I'm Pendarvis Harshaw, host of the Right Nowish podcast. Every week, I talk to the people who are creating art and culture and spreading it to the universe.
As an artist, you always meet yourself. Every year, you're a different person.
Essentially, we normalize a space where you can show up as your authentic self.
Check out Right Nowish, rooted in California's Bay Area, speaking to you.
It's so many people of color, so many queer people. It's like I'm being celebrated in my fullness.
Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tracy Thomas, host of One for the Books, and we are back for another round.
This is clearly an NPR audience.
Yeah, I think they're so smart. What the hell?
My guests this time are actor Vella Lavelle and author Amanda Montell, whose new book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, is out now. Join us on May 15th at the Crawford Family Forum for book talk, trivia, and hot takes. Tickets can be found at laist.com/events.
So how'd you get started with profiling these historic places? Tell us when you started, you know, blogging about it, I guess.
Sure. So it was September of 2021, and it was the middle of the pandemic. My wife and I were both working from home. We had a 4-year-old daughter at the time. She's 7 now. And I was just getting so bored of sitting at home. Bored, but also feeling disconnected from the city where I grew up. And so I was taking a bike ride and chose as a destination this weird structure I remembered seeing that's sort of on the edge of a cemetery in Burbank called the Pierce Brothers Valhalla Memorial Park. And I was just floored by how many different aspects of history this thing touched. So it used to be the entrance for this cemetery. It's this super fancy architecturally just like structure covered in this really... they call it Churriguer-esque stonework. And when the Burbank Airport was built 6 years later, they're like, there's too much aircraft noise coming over the entrance while people are like trying to have these solemn experiences. So they moved the entrance and 20 years later turned the structure into a shrine to aviation. And there's a big replica of a space shuttle from a movie. So, you know, unpacking this history and how it connects to aviation history and cemetery history, even Hollywood history, I was so blown away. And I noticed it was on the National Register of Historic Places. And I was like, if I've never heard of this thing after 40 years of living in Los Angeles, what else could be on the National Register that I need to know about? And that's how the whole thing started. There's a picture of me like pointing up to the National Register plaque on that first day. I knew at that moment that this was a project that I would happily spend many years on.
And were you always interested in history, or is it just because it was part hobby because you were a little bit bored, but also because you love LA? Like, was it like tapping your history geek, you know, or was it just like all the things?
Sure. No, it's a good question. I would say that I was never a history geek. My dad was an architect. And so I remember him taking me and my mom around to like a lot of buildings that he wanted to visit, not just in LA, like around the world too. And so I think I sort of had that in my bones. It was never a passion of mine, but it really felt like a sense of discovery. you know, once I went to that first place, maybe untapping something deep within me that I didn't know about.
What are your favorites and what are some of the highlights you might want to share with us?
Oh man, it really changes. Like, I can tell you some of my favorite discoveries for sure. I've turned into a total geek for this architect, John Lautner. I guess you could call him a mid-century modern architect, but he doesn't really fit in cleanly with anything. He invented Googie architecture, but he's really known for these just experimental houses with like soaring concrete ceilings, interesting use of wood and space, and sort of blurring the line between inside and outside. You've probably seen some of his houses, like they've been used in, you know, Body Double and The Big Lebowski and one of the Lethal Weapon movies. One of his houses is like, it basically like falls off a cliff. So that's been really huge for me. Another one that really hit me a lot, I actually visited on my birthday last year, is the Saddle Rock Pictograph site, which is like up in the hills up above Malibu. And it's on a private wine ranch. But the Chumash Native Americans painted some of the most important art in the entire LA area in a cave that's sort of in the center of this ranch. And it's four people on horseback. Horses didn't exist in Southern California until the Spaniards came. So researchers think that this artwork depicts the first contact between the Chumash and Gaspar de Portola, who's like the first European to explore California. So that was super moving to me because not only is it a document from an indigenous perspective of this like earth-shakingly important event, but it also, it's almost like this this hinge point between two eras of LA history. So that was super meaningful.
So how do things kind of land on the National Register? Like, how does that happen?
It's an interesting process. When you think of something like the National Register, you probably think, okay, there's some governmental body in Washington that is saying like, you, 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 and you. You're all on the National Register. And it's not like that at all. In fact, the federal government is sort of the last step in the process. So what usually happens is there will be a local organization or person, and it could be a property owner, it could be a historical organization, and they'll nominate something for inclusion in the National Register. And so first it goes to the California State Organization that handles this stuff, and then if they approve it, it's kicked over to the National Register, who either approves it or doesn't approve it. So if you think about it, in order to get on the National Register, a site really needs a champion, like someone that actively wants it to be there and is willing to put in the time and effort. That's great, but it also means there are some strange omissions, like buildings you'd think would be on the National Register that aren't. Mm-hmm. So like the example I give is there are 30 bungalow courts just in Pasadena, just like this one, Gartz Court, where we're at right now, that are on the National Register. And yet the Griffith Observatory is not. The Hollywood Bowl was just added in December of last year. And there are all kinds of reasons why something might not end up on the National Register. It could be like the owner objects, or the owner doesn't see the point, or like it's famous enough that it doesn't need any kind of protection that the National Register inclusion might give it, you know?
And once a property is on the register, it makes it a lot harder to tear down or make significant changes to it.
How has the discovery of historic landmarks taught you or helped you fall in love more with LA? Like, what is it like?
I would say that when you grow up, your sense of the city is really dependent on, you know, where you go to school, the restaurants that your parents take you to. And it's all very experiential. It's based on what are the things I care about when I'm a kid, when I'm a teen, when I'm a 20-something. I think looking into historical landmarks, it teaches me about all the other stuff that I didn't even conceive was part of Los Angeles history. So like social history for demographics that I'm not part of, you know, natural history, Native American history, even stuff that like I really don't care about, like gas and the economy or oil. Mm-hmm. There's just so much of that stuff that just like permeates LA history. And it just sort of like, it's exciting to like discover this whole new world of stuff to explore just because you went to one landmark.
That was Eitan Rosenblum. You can follow his adventures in LA on his website and socials. He's Eitan, that's E-T-A-N, does LA everywhere. That's it for us today, and thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, please subscribe so you don't miss any new How to LA episodes. Alrighty, y'all. Hasta luego, friends. This episode was produced by Monica Bushman. Our How to LA team also includes Erica Washington, Evan Jacoby, Megan Botel, and Victoria Alejandro. Our executive producer is Megan Larson, and our engineer is Hazmik Pagosian. Support for this podcast is made possible by Gordon and Donna Crawford, who believe that quality journalism makes Los Angeles a better place to live.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.